Hey everyone, it's the Kung Fu Genius, aka Alex Richter. And if you're listening to us on audio only, I'd appreciate you rating and reviewing the podcast wherever you listen to it. And of course, if you like what I do here, don't forget to subscribe to the Kung Fu Genius on YouTube and hit that bell for notifications. Are you a fan of Wing Chun Kung Fu? Well, if you listen to me, I assume you are. I got great news for Kung Fu Genius fans. Right now, you can get an all-access one-month free trial subscription to Wing Chun Illustrated Magazine. Yes, I said free. Go to WCINewsstand.com and register in the upper right-hand corner, fill in your email and password, and use the code KFGTRIAL to get your free trial to the issues from 2011 to the current issue. That's right, all the issues, even the one with this guy on the cover. My Kung Fu Genius column is in all the new issues, as if you need another reason to get this awesome magazine. Go get your free trial subscription today. For all that information, check out the description below. And with that, let's get started.
All right, peeps, on today's episode of the Kung Fu Genius, the genius will be answering all sorts of hot nonsense from YouTube. Lots of gems, lots of William Cheung, and lots of, well, Jackie Chan didn't do all of his stunts. Let's get to it.
He is unstoppable, unbeatable, unbelievable. He's Alex Richter, the Kung Fu Genius.
And every day, I practice martial arts. What's up?
Word is, I'm a Kung Fu Genius. Practiced all day like a genius.
Yo, Dre, how you doing, man?
All right, Sifu, I'm doing great.
Good to see you, man. You know, you keep switching up your looks week to week. It's kind of crazy.
I don't know. I mean, I don't quite feel myself today, you know, but like, I feel more refined, though.
You definitely sound more refined than you normally do.
You know, I'll apologize in advance. You might find some of my responses a little more reserved.
Okay, understood. So here we are with another Ask Me Anything episode. And so you got questions. I hopefully have answers. So let's get to it.
All right, so our first question comes from someone named Achung. Kung Fu Genius. I added that part.
Oh, okay.
What are your thoughts on the Wing Chun used in Bruce Lee movies, Alita, Battle Angel, and in Warriors 2.
Ah, is that Bruce Lee, like Bruce L.I. or Bruce L.E.E., or which is it?
It's actually Bruce L.I., yes.
Oh, okay. As I mentioned in the past, I'm the most unqualified person to talk about all those Bruce Lee exploitation movies, because since I was a kid, those things were just the four-stripe Adidas to me, and I just didn't want to wear them. And, you know, like there's Polo, and then there's like that Polo Association brand, right, in New York.
Yeah.
And I think there was that meme that was going around. It was like, no, Mom, not that Polo. And like she bought like all the Polo Association stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Not the real Polo.
I mean, let me just quickly check what sneakers. Oh, no, okay, we're good.
Okay. So for me, just the Bruce Lee, L-I-L-E stuff just always just seemed kind of like that to me. So I rejected it kind of wholesale and haven't really watched too many of those. I know that there's one movie that he does. I think Yip Chun is actually in it playing Yip Man. And yeah, I know.
Wow.
And I think that he actually does some, like my friend Vincent Benitez, who we had on the podcast, he told me that the Wing Chun is actually pretty good in there. But that doesn't matter to me because I will never watch it.
Ah, okay.
So what were the other movies?
Warriors 2 was the other movie.
Mm. So Warriors 2 is or was Sammo Hung's first attempt to put Wing Chun in a movie. And I think part of the reason was Shaw Brothers, because they were getting Lau Ka Leung, was the, one of their directors, along with Chang Che, and his style was Hong Gar. So I think Golden Harvest at that time wanted to do something different from what Shaw was doing. So with Lau Ka Leung's influence, they had a lot of Hong Kun in their films, and a lot of the films were about Hong Kun practitioners.
Right.
So I think Sammo got the idea to say, well, why don't we do the opposite? Let's do Wing Chun instead. So Warriors 2 was his first attempt to put Wing Chun in, you know, have a Wing Chun-themed movie, so to speak. And it's you can't say that it's based on a true story. You can say that the characters in the movie are based on actual people from our Wing Chun lineage, our Wing Chun history. The story, of course, is complete fiction, like most Chinese kung fu narratives. It actually tells the story. And the Chinese title, the exact Chinese title escapes me, but I believe it's basically like, you know, Mr. John and Money Changer Wah, which is the name of his student, right? And basically, it's about Leung John. Leung John being kind of one of the most famous practitioners of Wing Chun in our line. And Leung John was the Si Gong of Yip Man.
Oh, okay.
So, and Leung John before Yip Man was perhaps like the most famous of all the Wing Chun practitioners. And he was very similar in many respects to Wong Fei-hung, who's kind of the patriarch of the Hungar style. Leung John was not only an ass kicker in his chosen style of Wing Chun, but he was also, like many, you know, purported kung fu masters of that time, he was also an herbal doctor, and he was also like a very upright person, and, you know, all in that kind of mold of what like a traditional proper Chinese sifu is. And also, like Wong Fei-hung, from the town of Fatsan.
Ah.
And it's really crazy that you have all these famous kung fu masters that they all came from this one seemingly random town in the Canton province, because China's so big and there's so many cities and towns that had kung fu masters, but Fatsan in particular just seemed to kind of pump out lots of these iconic martial art masters of Wong Fei-hung and Leung Jian, and then later Yip Man, right? So Sammo's first attempt, well, first of all, anything that Sammo Hung does is awesome, all right? And that's pretty much from the beginning. He's just one of the best choreographers. At that time when he was still performing, he was one of the best stunt performers. So there are very few Sammo Hung movies where they kind of miss the mark. There are a few, but for the most part, Sammo, you know, what was that, Passenger 57, always bet on black?
Yeah, that was with Wesley Snipes.
Wesley Snipes, right? You always bet on Sammo. Sammo always does good stuff. So Warriors 2 is pretty awesome. It is his first attempt at putting Wing Chun on this big screen. So he had learned a little bit of Wing Chun for the sake of making that movie and choreographing it, but he is not a Wing Chun guy.
Right.
So they take a lot of creative license with it. So like you'll see a lot of Wing Chun movements, but then you'll also see a spinning kick. You know, you'll see a lot of Wing Chun movements, and then there'll also be like lots of acrobatic stuff kind of thrown in there. But that was pretty normal at that time. The choreography is pretty awesome. It has great training sequences when Leung Jian, who is played by Leung Gayan, who is affectionately known in the Western world as Beardy because of his beard. And very funny, he's known by many people as a Wing Chun practitioner, that many people think he's a Wing Chun practitioner because he played Leung Jian in Warriors 2, and he also used Wing Chun in some other roles. He's not even a martial artist.
Oh, wow.
He was just trained for the roles that he played, but he was so good and Sammo Hung's choreography was so on point, he was able to pull off being one of the most famous masters of Wing Chun without even really being a martial artist. That's how good Sammo and how good Hong Kong choreography was at that time. You can take people who didn't really know anything and make it look like they knew something. So it's pretty good. The training sequences are great. They have some crazy stuff where the dummies are like on these rails and they're coming down and moving around. They have some cool stuff with the long pole where he's got to crack the nuts with the tangguan. And there's some really, really cool stuff. The end fight scene is pretty long. And it takes lots of creative license with what Wing Chun actually is. Some people don't like the fact that, spoiler alert, Leung Jian gets killed in the movie, which some Wing Chun purists don't like that story point. But it's pretty good. I think his sophomore attempt at putting Wing Chun in film, which was The Prodigal Son, was a far superior effort. One is just a way better movie, and then the Wing Chun was also a lot tighter. But Warriors 2, we have a Warriors 2 poster upstairs, an original Golden Harvest one there in the gym. Also very iconic movie. I think the other one he mentioned was Alita.
Yes.
I saw Alita, and there's only, as far as I can tell, she's like it's like a futuristic movie. She's like a robot or something like that. And there's one scene where she's doing martial arts like on her own, and she busts out like a bunch of Wing Chun moves. But from what I can tell, I didn't really see her use too much of it. But I only saw it once, and I saw it. And it's one of those movies that I kind of watch while also looking at my phone.
Yeah.
So I can't really speak too much on that. But I remember it being pretty decent. But that's about all I got to say on that.
I was going to ask the question, who was in the original Warriors? And then I realized that actually it was Warriors 2. As in. It as a sequel.
Oh, okay. Or I was also thinking, like, you were thinking about, like, Warriors Come Out and Play. Like, no. Warriors 2 is definitely not a sequel to, what is that, The Warriors,
The Warriors,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it could have been just something called Warriors, but it's like, oh, yeah, Warriors 2, they got him in for the sequel.
No, yeah, no, that is a, was a common trope that they used to translate for Western titles. There's also another film called Heroes 2. And has had nothing to do with the Chinese title. Like, again, the Chinese title of Warriors 2, I think, is like Leung Jian, or Mr. Leung Jian and Chan Hua Sun, or Zhao Qin Hua, or something like that. It's literally like this guy and this guy. The funny thing is, most of the time, the Chinese titles are obviously the correct ones and the ones you want to learn. But in the case of Hong Kong films, sometimes the English title is better than the Chinese title, because one of the side effects of that, I've learned to read a lot of Chinese characters, is I can read a lot of the titles of these kung fu movies.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have like all these kung fu movies with like crazy cool names. And then you read the Chinese title and it's like so-and-so and so-and-so. That's literally the Chinese title. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh. You know, like you see some of the titles and you're like, that's the rare time where actually the English title might be better than the original titles.
Well, bearing in mind that you have like a Star Wars poster in Chinese in your, you know, in your house.
Says who? Blasphemy.
Well, maybe you don't. All I'm saying is, would you say the Chinese title for Star Wars was better than the English one?
The Chinese title for Star Wars, I think, is like Planet Big War or Planet War, right?
Amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a quite literal, I think it's like Xingkao Dai Jin, yeah, which is like Planet War. Or yeah, so it's not exactly Star Wars, right?
Right, okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you very much, Achung. So we're going to our next one from Thomas Maxted. Hi there, Sifu Alex and Mr. Dre. Exclamation mark.
Mm-hmm.
I'm loving these AMA videos. Keep up the good work! Exclamation mark. My question is related to Chi Sao. I have practiced Jeet Kune Do and remember you mentioned you have trained with some Junfan JKD people in the past. Based on your experience, would you say it's worth a JKD practitioner to study Wing Chun if they want to improve their Chi Sao? It seems with the JKD guys, they get the skills needed from it, but looks a lot more basic and unsophisticated when compared to the Wing Chun guys. I'd love to hear your opinion as I'm thinking of studying Wing Chun further. Regards, Tom.
That's a great question. I mean, it's a little out of my wheelhouse because, and the reason I say it's out of my wheelhouse is that because Jeet Kune Do, as it's practiced all over the world now, is so, it's practiced in so many divergent ways. You have guys who are more traditional to what Bruce Lee did, so-called original JKD people. Then you have JKD concepts that like to have a more kind of conceptual-based idea of martial arts and perhaps are a little bit more on the eclectic mixing styles end of things. And so the problem is that spectrum is too broad for me to say what someone should do. Also, far be it from me as a Wing Chun instructor to tell Jeet Kune Do people what they should do in their art. I can barely tell Wing Chun people to do in their art, and I do Wing Chun. So, but he does make a point. A lot of the Chi Sao that I see practiced by many of the Jeet Kune Do people is pretty rudimentary. It's nothing. I mean, most Wing Chun people would look at it, even some of the stuff that Bruce Lee did in those demonstrations, those Chi Sao demonstrations, and it's pretty basic. Now, I'm not saying that as a criticism. Basic Chi Sao done correctly could be all that you need, right? The mistake some people make in Wing Chun is they think, oh, because they learn all the stuff in the wooden dummy and all the Byuji and they can do all this stuff, that automatically makes them better. Well, it only makes you better if you can actually apply those things or you actually have an understanding of how to use those things. If you're just accumulating drills and movements and ideas, but you cannot apply it, well, then it really doesn't matter. In that case, it's probably better to have a super stripped down basic system of Chi Sao, but be able to apply it. Having said that, obviously, if a Jeet Kune Do person wants to improve the skill of Chi Sao specifically, as it seems to be the case here with Thomas, yeah, well, then for sure, you probably want to go to someone who specializes in that. But, you know, people ask me all the time, what do I think of, like, the Chi Sao done in JKD? and I tell them something that usually shocks them a little bit. I don't have an opinion on it. And it tends to shock people because people think you have to have an opinion on everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't. There are certain things where you could just say, well, it doesn't affect me in any kind of way, so I actually don't really burn a whole lot of energy in terms of what Jeet Kune Do people are doing or not doing in terms of T-cell. If someone really tried to nail me down and get my opinion, I would just say it's kind of basic, but that doesn't mean it doesn't work. So it's up to the individual.
That's fair. Okay, cool.
By the way, I have to say these questions, you sound so much more sophisticated this week.
Well, thank you, Steve.
Yes.
Thank you. I feel more sophisticated.
Have you been reading lately or something? What's going on?
Actually, I've been reading through, you know, the classics, you know, Crime and Punishment, you know, a bit Franz Kafka.
Got it.
It really, really...
Clockwork Orange.
Oh, man, I've read that book too many times. It's really refined the vocabulary right. and the palette, I find.
Right,
you know?
Right, right. Yes.
Absolutely.
Also, I think the gray in the beard is also bringing out a certain refinement that you normally don't have, Dre.
Well, sometimes you just have to become more of an adult.
Sure, sure. And you know what people don't realize is you're not one of those guys who's got a shaved head usually because you're bald. You choose it, but you decided to grow your hair in, so this is a unique look.
I think there's a correlation, direct correlation, between how articulate I am and how much hair I have.
That seems to be the case, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we're going to move on to our next question from Roberto S. Please provide more details on the Wing Chun training facility that you are opening in Florida. Oh, time for a plug there, Seaford.
Ooh, time for a plug.
Mm-hmm. South Florida residents such as myself are dying to know.
Wow.
Also, please discuss what run-in you had with actor David Carradine several years ago.
Ooh.
I know he had the reputation of being difficult.
Ooh. Wow, the David Carradine story.
Are you ready for this?
Yeah, I think I told it once on Dudes, but I definitely haven't told it on Kung Fu Genius.
No, you haven't.
All right, well, the first question about the Florida thing, that's come up a couple times. So, yeah, I recently purchased a small property house in near Orlando, so about 10 minutes away from Disney and all of that hot nonsense over there. And we bought it basically because... you can't afford any property in New York City. You could be the most or one of the most successful Kung Fu instructors in New York City and not be able to afford a place mm-hmm. in the city you live in.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So we decided, you know, we wanted to buy some property at this point in our lives. So we went somewhere where we could afford it. And that place was called Florida. So we got a small place down there. But the idea is that I have a lot of private students who come to New York to train with me, and sometimes they come to our big events like the ITC, or sometimes they just come for a week or two or whatever to train here. But it is kind of expensive sometimes for people to come to New York City and stay in a hotel. So we thought, well, maybe we can have an alternative option for people. If they don't want to come and spend all this money at a hotel, they could give all that money to me instead. No, all jokes aside, people could come and train with me privately at the Florida location. And because it's a house, the package would actually include them just staying there. So basically you get to train and hang out with the Kung Fu Genius. It's kind of like a full-on immersion course. The course is about 20 lessons a week, 20 private lessons. Of course, there's an option to do more, and people can also do it semi-privately. So if you want to come with a buddy or a training partner or whatever, that's also an option. And I'm going to outfit the garage with the dummy and wall bags and all the equipment and stuff we need. There's a back patio for people who are learning long pole. And if it's just too damn hot, we're going to train inside the air-conditioned home. The garage might be too hot. The patio might be too hot because we were just there last week. It was like over 100 degrees. It was ridiculous. But Wing Chun doesn't take a lot of space, so we can also train inside the house. So basically, it's a chance for instructors, especially in the WT line. But even Wing Chun people who come from elsewhere, they can also learn from me too. But obviously, mostly WT people, you can come. All of this stuff's going to be on the website at citywt.com. You have to apply for it because my time is also quite booked, so we want to make sure that people who do it are serious, because I have to leave New York for a week or two and fly down to Florida, so we want to make sure these are, you know, obviously serious people. But all that information is at citywt.com, so you can get more info there. Okay. The second question, the David Carradine story. So the David Carradine story is interesting. It happened very early on in my teaching career here in New York. I started teaching Wing Chun in 2002. which is why next year is going to be the 20th anniversary of City Wing Chun. We're going to have a huge event. But, you know, when I first started, it was like, you know, just teaching at a dance studio. Things were really small. I talked about this on other podcasts. I really didn't have the connections that I would get later in my teaching career. But pretty early on, I had the most random opportunity to be on a panel with David Carradine. I think it was 2003. So I had only been teaching for a year. I was super green. And someone I knew was running some panels for the New York Comic Con. And then asked me and said, hey, do you want to talk about Asian martial arts in American film on a panel? Because this person had heard me talk once about martial art movies and knew that I might know a thing or two about it, right? So I was like, cool. And he was like, yeah, David Carradine's going to be on the panel. And I was like, whoa, crazy. Because right at that time was when Kill Bill 1 had come out.
Right.
So David Carradine had this, like, kind of late in his life resurgence in his career.
It was somewhat of a renaissance, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Because I think right before Kill Bill, he was selling those rubber dildo exercise things on. Do you remember that infomercial?
Oh my God, yeah. And the thing about it is, I heard that, you know, that Kung Fu wasn't big in the UK, you know, the series.
It's weird you would bring up the UK randomly, Dre. I thought you grew up in Brooklyn.
I did. But there's, I don't know, it's something about, I guess, just reading the books and everything, like
got
Shakespeare.
I
feel this affinity.
Yes.
Like I would know that fact randomly.
Right. It's very, you know, random.
You know, sort of certainly, you know, my personal kind of memory of David Carradine is actually Death Race 2000.
Ooh, I remember Death Race 2000. Stallone
was
in that one.
Stallone was in that as well.
I remember one special effect where they ran over someone's head and it very obviously looked like a watermelon. Mm-hmm. It was so fake.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But like, and then after that, it's like, I mean, I knew who David Carradine was, but like,
right.
I couldn't tell you anything else.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
he was in any time up until Kill Bill.
Right. Yeah. It's weird because here, like, the Kung Fu TV series was such a big deal. And when I meet with people who are, like, let's say, 5 to 10 years older than me or at least older, they're all like, oh, man, I love the Kung Fu TV series. What do you think about that? And my first introduction into Chinese martial arts was Bruce Lee and Enter the Dragon. My dad rented that. I saw Bruce Lee, saw all these Kung Fu movies. Mm-hmm. And then my dad went to the video store and randomly rented, like, the pilot episode of the Kung Fu TV series with David Carradine. And I remember watching that and going, like, this guy sucks, right? Because the problem is there's something called the primacy effect. The first thing that you see of something mm-hmm. is usually the one that sticks out in your mind. Well, for a certain generation of Americans, they saw David Carradine on the Kung Fu TV series before those Bruce Lee films came.
Yeah.
So for them, oh, it was Kung Fu. And then when Bruce Lee came, like, oh, this guy's super amazing, right? But I saw the other way around. I saw Bruce Lee first.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't go backwards from Bruce Lee to David Carradine.
No.
So whereas a lot of people went from David Carradine forwards to Bruce Lee, mm-hmm. I started with that stuff. So when I saw David Carradine, I mean, the dude couldn't even lift his leg. The dude was terrible.
Yeah.
So I wasn't like a, wow, he's David Carradine, the Kung Fu guy. In 2003, when I got invited to do that panel, I'm like, wow, he's like Kill Bill, Quentin Tarantino. It's a big deal. And I had seen, I'm not 100% sure. I think the first Kill Bill had already come out, but the second one had not come out yet. I think it was right in between there, but I could be mistaken. It's a long time ago. So anyway, we get invited to this panel, and I'm on there, and I'm there with my good friend, John Ficarra. John is, at that time, he was teaching stage combat here. And now he's since gone on, and he's like a kind of a big deal in the car industry. He did film cars for a while. And John Ficarra is actually the guy who created the City Wing Chun logo.
Oh, okay.
And so
nice.
Very early on, and he actually built this very office that we, I think Galway framed it, but they built it. Many of the original things that were built in the school were built by John Ficarra. And because he was teaching stage combat, he was just starting out and he needed a place to teach stage combat. So he started teaching his classes at City Wing Chun. And kind of as a barter, he built stuff for me. And he created my logo, and he did all sorts of things. So mm-hmm. John Ficarra is a shout out to John Ficarra. He's absolutely
Shout out to John Ficarra. I've not met you, but you sound fantastic.
He's awesome. He's amazing, and he has amazing facial hair that you can only be envious of. He's got an amazing beard, and it's always trimmed in a way where you go like, "This is facial hair of the gods."
Oh my God, I suffer terrible beard envy. You know, I'm looking relatively well groomed.
Not too bad.
You know, occasionally I'll try and let it grow out, and it gets to a point, and it's just
Yeah, I have a patchy beard. It's like, when I see people with strong beards, like, yeah, you get that beard envy. You go, wow. And you know what comes up on my Instagram?
Mm-hmm.
Those things where you can fill in, like, for the beards and stuff, where it's like fake hair you draw in there. I'm like, why is Instagram showing me this?
Absolutely.
How do they know about my patchy beard, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, back to David Carradine. So John Ficarra's there, I remember there was another guy on the panel. His name, I believe, is Rob. His last name escapes me, but he used to be Michael J. Fox's stunt double on the TV show Spin City.
Oh,
and he
wow.
was also a stage combat guy. Super, super cool dude. So we're on there and we're like the experts and David Carradine is there. Well, we were on the panel for an hour. Long story short, on the panel, not a single one of us got one word in edgewise because David Carradine talked the whole time. I mean, to be fair, the audience was there. They were asking him questions.
Yeah.
I look like a Germans have a term, it's called a Milchbubi, which is like a milk booby, which is like a young kid or like a man who still looks like a kid, right? So mm-hmm. I was like a Milchbubi right there next to David Carradine and these other like, you know, two guys that no one wanted to ask us anything. It's freaking David Carradine was right there. So like I get it in hindsight. At the time I was very disappointed because David Carradine would say something and in my mind I'd be like, I know way more about movies than this idiot.
Yeah.
Because all he would do is, he didn't actually talk about the topic, he just talked about himself.
Yeah, of course.
And the odd thing is I remember he would just name drop all the time. And it's like, dude, you're already a movie. We know you're a movie star. But he's like, you know, when I went to the premiere with Uma and blah, 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 and saying like this. And I just remember going like, because this was one of the first times I was in the orbit of a higher tier celebrity.
Yeah.
And just going like, oh, man, this is what you expect from like the waitress at the diner who's trying.
Oh, absolutely.
But he was like, he was so try hard. And I'm like, dude, you're freaking David Carradine. Why are you talking like you have to name drop everyone so people know that you're a dude? It's like, we get it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the whole hour, no one asks us anything. And we literally don't have a chance to get in a word in edgewise. Because as we're about to, like, he'll say, someone will ask something, he'll answer. We'll be about to comment. They'll just take the next question. Like, so I basically sat next to him for an hour and didn't open my mouth once. All right? So it's just like, all right, whatever. Couple highlights from that thing. One, someone asked him about like, well, what do you feel about the fact that you took the role of Kane away from Bruce Lee? And it was like, wow, someone actually asked him that because that's always the big thing about, you know, they gave it to the white guy or whatever, right? And then I remember his answer was, that's ancient mythology. He goes, I never took the role from Bruce Lee. It was never really his to begin with. I remember when he said that, he was right next to me.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you ever have these fantasies you play out in your head and then you snap to and then you realize like none of that happened, right?
I just
gave him a fox out right to the neck, full power. I was looking at him and just thinking like, I could crack this guy so hard right now. I'd get in trouble, but I'd forever be the guy who cracked David Carradine on stage. And I remember going through it because I got so angry when he said that. Turns out I was actually wrong. It's actually true that he didn't really steal that role from Bruce Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, he's an actor. He's going to take whatever role he gets. So, I mean, first of all, you have that whole thing there. But apparently Bruce Lee was not as much in the running for that role as it's been mythologized over the years. He was someone that they considered, but then decided not to go with. He actually had this other idea called The Warrior, and oftentimes his Warrior TV show idea and the Kung Fu TV show, people conflate these two things as being the same thing, and then that's where some of the confusion is. But I remember when he said that, I was so angry, I just wanted to deck him. Turns out, David Carradine was actually right on that point, but whatever.
Well, yeah, but here, I mean, putting it to you like an alternative perspective, and you know, this is like a kind of like, what's it, like a thought experiment or anything. We're just looking back in hindsight. Knowing now what you know then about him with the experience you had with him there, like, you know, on paper that sounds quite a noble response to say and be honest about it.
Right.
But, you know, maybe he's like, yeah, it was never his to begin with because I was better. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a little strange. I mean, at the time that David Carradine got that role, I mean, I think he had done a couple Broadway shows and he was known somewhat as a dancer, which is funny because he's so god. His movement is always so god awful. Again, I alluded to it earlier, but around the time of Kill Bill, his career was in such a slump. He was doing infomercials for this fitness tool.
Yes.
And you hold it in your hand, and it's literally, I would say, a 2-foot section of rubber garden hose.
Wow, so it's not even like a double-length shake weight.
No, it's not a double-length shake weight or anything like that, right? And you hold it, and you just move it around like this. Like it, the thing is, clearly whoever created it had at one point created something that required thousands of these 2-foot section of garden hoses, and then that company went bankrupt, and then the guy's in his basement with 2,000 of these things going like, how the hell can I sell this damn thing? Oh, I got an idea. Wait, can you exercise with this thing? Like, maybe for old people? What if I get David Carradine to pitch this thing, right?
You, David Carradine's agent. David, I've got a really, really great job for you. It's going to bring you back to the big time.
Yeah. And the infomercial is available on YouTube, okay? And I definitely implore our listeners to finish this episode, and as soon as you're done watching this episode, immediately look up David Carradine infomercial and tell me that that thing doesn't just look like a rubber dildo he's moving around his head. It's ridiculous. And he's like, but it's, you know, I mean, like, even the shake weight is a ridiculous thing. But when you look at the shake weight, you go, at least it's a weight.
Yes.
And by shaking it, you have to like hold it and use strength, and you can kind of see, even though it's completely ridiculous, it is exercise. David Carradine is literally pitching a 2-foot section of rubber garden hose that you just hold on both ends and move the thing around like this. And you have to listen to him try to sell this thing. He's like, when you put it in your hand, you don't know why, but it tells you how to move. It's a freaking 2-foot section of rubber garden hose, David. It is not telling you anything. You are selling me a 2-foot section of rubber garden hose. Stop pretending this is a thing. Someone had a company that required these things. That company went belly up, and he's sitting on these things. How am I going to get rid of it?
Yeah.
David Carradine to the rescue. So anyway, so this is all happening around the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he says this thing about, you know, it's ancient mythology. I was pissed off at that time. Turns out I was actually wrong. Okay. At one point, someone in the audience goes, some total, you can imagine, like New York Comic Con nerd, Mr. Carradine. In your IMDb or whatever, maybe IMDb wasn't there at the time, but whatever, like online list films or whatever, you know, because he, for someone who was very B-list in certain times of his career, actually, he was extremely prolific as an actor because he would basically take anything they gave him. So he worked a lot. Said, in some movie you starred in 1976 or 77, you played a guitar. And I wanted to know, do you really play guitar in real life? That was the question. It was something like that, right?
Wow.
And then David is like, you know, yes, I play the guitar. And then the guy goes, I have a guitar right here. I want to hear you play it. And I was like, holy crap. This guy's calling out David Carradine to see if this dude actually knows how to play guitar. And I'm sitting there already just like, because again, this is maybe 45 minutes into the 1-hour panel. David Carradine has totally hogged it. He's been talking the whole time. He's been name dropping. He's been the total douchebag celebrity, super self-obsessed. And now I'm like, wow, somebody's calling him out to see if he actually plays guitar. And maybe he's going to just totally fall flat on his dick right now, right? And so I'm just like, I'm waiting, all right? The guy brings the guitar to David Carradine, and David is like, well, I only play guitars that... He said, is that thing tuned? I remember he asked, right? And then the guy, and then he goes, yeah, can you play us a song? He's like, oh, well, I only play songs that I've written or whatever. And the guy's like, all right, well, play us one of your songs. And I'm thinking here just going like, wow, this dude has put David Carradine in a box. David Carradine, so the panel was the four of us. It was John Ficarra, Rob, me, and I'm right next to David Carradine. And there's some photos from that where I'm sitting next to him. You see every photo, I'm just looking at him like, oh my God.
Oh yeah, no, it's, be careful. Someone might caption those of like, I wish someone would look at me the same way that the Kung Fu Genius is.
With my eyes searing through. So he stands up, and I think there's even a photo of him standing up with the guitar next to me, and we're all looking up at him like, oh my God, what a train wreck, okay? So he decides to sing a song that he supposedly wrote or was in one of the movies. I don't remember the exact thing. I don't remember the entire song because it was an original song. But I remember the final lines. Like they're seared into my brain. I tell you, 30 seconds before I die, it will be the thing I remember. Okay? What he said is seared into my soul. And it goes like this. He's got the guitar, he sang this, and the song's like freaking ridiculous. And at the end, he goes, "What if you get to the end of the rainbow and it ain't nothing but paint?" And then he strums, "Vroom, but what if it ain't?" So that was the end of the song, and I will never forget those words because they were so ridiculous, right? So the thing finishes up. I go up to David Carradine, and I go, "Mr. Carradine," just like when I met Van Damme, "Mr. Van Damme," right? "Mr. Carradine, it was an honor to be on the, you know, on the stage with you." And I was wondering if we could get a photo. And he looked right at me. And he leaned in. And he said, "Everything costs money, son."
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. I was the dude on the panel with him. Mind you, I didn't say shit.
Mm-hmm.
But he says that to me. And I remember, okay, I was the young version of the Kung Fu Genius. Still very green.
The Kung Fu Apprentice.
The Kung Fu Apprentice. Still very green, but I had my pride. I looked at him, and I gave him a salute, and I walked out. I just left. I was like, screw that. All right? Like, what a tool.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just remember just after that, we were like, what? That dude wanted me to pay? And the funny thing was, in the audience, there were some people who shot some photos. So I actually have photos of me on the panel with him, which are worth a lot more than like just a photo of me at Comic-Con with him, like I bumped into him.
Yeah.
So I actually got the photos anyway, Mr. Carradine. And
you know, he can't actually hear you now.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, and then I guess I get the last laugh because 5 years later he died in a masturbation accident or something like that, right? So, yeah. So anyway.
It's an embarrassing death that cannot be spun.
Yeah, yeah. Although there are some people that believe that he was murdered. Mm-hmm. I'm not a tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist. But let's just say I know someone who knew David Carradine.
Mm-hmm.
And this person laid out to me in about 30 minutes a very plausible scenario for David Carradine actually having been murdered and that thing being staged.
Yes.
But I don't have any skin in the game, so I'm like, okay, all right, that's fine.
We can save that for another podcast.
Maybe I'll get the guy who told me to say it. Mm-hmm. David Carradine does, to kind of go back to what was also said in that question, he does have a reputation for being, have a reputation for being kind of a dick at those conventions. And I'm not going to mention his name, but a good friend of mine who's also a celebrity who does those conventions, he was on a panel with David Carradine, and David Carradine apparently told some young kid to get effing lost. So I suppose, you know, David Carradine was not as nasty to me as he was to some child. So I suppose I did win out something, right?
Wow. Yay for you.
Yeah, yay for me, right? So that was basically it. Funny thing. So I got a couple photos next to David Carradine, which, you know, for whatever it's worth, I have that. But the interesting thing is that there was someone in the audience. His name was Douglas Ferguson. And he's kind of now he's a it's like an independent filmmaker. And at that time, he was just kind of getting started. And he came up to me after that that panel and asked me if he was going to be in a play, a kung fu play called White Eyebrow and the Destruction of Shaolin. And he said they need a place to rehearse. And he wanted to know if they could rehearse at my school. Mm-hmm. And I was like, fine. And so they used my school to rehearse. And in the play was Mike Yan, who then became one of my students, became a Sifu under me, and now he's a huge Hollywood stuntman.
Yeah.
And also the fight choreographer was a guy named Galway. Galway's a very good friend. He put up the Gusang dummy a couple years ago when we got it.
Oh, okay. So
because of that David Carradine thing, someone was in the audience who later ended up becoming a friend, introducing me to a bunch of people. And then a number of my actor friends who are still very active today, I met because of that panel.
Yeah.
So while David Carradine was a tool, that event actually ended up being very fortuitous, I guess, in my career because of the people that it introduced me to. So
Right. That's
my David Carradine story. Hey, Kung Fu Genius listeners, if you're a Wing Chun practitioner, especially from the WT or Leung Ting line, and want to get really personalized immersion training with me, you can now apply to do an immersion course with me here in NYC, or if you like the sun, in my Florida home near Orlando. These courses are for instructors or anyone who's serious about learning the art in detail and working hard. I teach in program blocks like Siunam Tao, Cham Kyu, Biu Ji, Wooden Dummy, and those include the Chi Sao theory, fighting applications, and training methods as well. If you're really serious about learning Wing Chun, check out the link in the description below to find out about applying for a spot. For those of you who are not quite ready to do full private immersion training, you can also apply for a spot at either our winter or summer intensive training camps. We have a few spots available for non-city Wing Chun students, so apply today. A link for those options are in the description below. And now back to me.
Well, let's move on to the next question then. JDMV Tech. In your own opinion, have you found people that come from a different martial art or combat sports become a better Wing Chun practitioner than those that have learned Wing Chun from scratch? Appreciate the podcast. It's fun and informative. Been practicing Wing Chun for over 10 years myself, and you still drop nuggets of history I was not aware of. Loving the castle stories. Keep that up.
It's great to hear people appreciating what we do here. Wow, that's a very difficult question to answer because, here in New York, we have so many different students that come from different backgrounds. And whether someone comes from a very prolific previous martial arts practice or history or career before coming to me or they don't, has almost no bearing on how good or poorly they learn Wing Chun because it's so individual. Sometimes you have people who have years and years of martial arts training in another style. And when they come to Wing Chun, they have a really hard time adapting. Like someone who has years of Taekwondo with a side-on stance and hands down, now they have to learn to stay square, use their hands, keep your hands up, stick to the guy, get close. Sometimes years and years of previous martial arts experience can be a hindrance because they have to unlearn what they have done before. They have to change habits that are muscle memory that are ingrained, and they have to learn new movement patterns. But sometimes you have people from other martial arts who've done years and years of other martial arts. They come because they want to learn Wing Chun and they appreciate it. And they're really able to empty their cup because they understand the only way they're going to get good at this is if they put all the stuff they learned previously aside and learn this thing with fresh eyes. So whether someone has that attitude or not, is not dependent on how long they did martial arts. You have people, they came to me, they did martial arts for 20 years, and they have like two left feet trying to learn Wing Chun. And you have people that come to me, they did martial arts for 30 years, and they pick it up right away because they're able to compartmentalize and separate what they learned before. So it's up to the individual. Some people assimilate new stuff much more easily, and other people have a really hard time because they filter everything through the lens of what they've been doing for the last 10, 20 years. So it's really difficult to tell. In general, someone who has never learned anything before, they don't have any bad habits to break, but they also might not be used to training in martial arts, or they might not have a lot of mobility or additional skills that could be helpful. So for me, hands down, the easiest students to teach are dancers. Regardless of dance background. Yeah, and not just someone like, yo, I dance at the club. Because in that case, we are all dancers here.
Maybe not. Some people might say they're dancers, but I've been to the club.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I heard you've been there a couple times.
Yeah, more than a few times, unfortunately.
So, I mean, people who actually studied dance and performed and did it. And it doesn't actually matter the discipline of dance, because we've had students here that were very high-level break dancers. They learn Wing Chun quickly. High-level ballerinas, they learn Wing Chun quickly. High-level classical dance, they learn Wing Chun quickly because
their brain's already kind of trained for the choreography of all of these.
Well, what I feel, although, and it could be different with all of those groups, is that a dancer has to see a dance or see choreography and they have to pick it up right away. A dancer doesn't go, oh, well, those first five steps are different than the five steps I did last week. No, because your job is dependent on you learning that. It doesn't matter what you did last week. This week, you got to learn these steps like this. So I find the reason why dancers tend to pick up martial arts more quickly is because they view it as choreography, even when it's not. When you show them how to step forward and punch, they're not thinking about stepping forward and punching. They're thinking about how they shift their weight and move forward and how it's, and they're going to try to mimic how the instructor does it. Even if they don't understand it from a conceptual standpoint, they can imitate it much more quickly than someone who doesn't have that background. And since they're imitating the movement, they have the physical movement down, and that's already the first step for them to then figure out how to do it. They can essentially fake it until they make it much more quickly than people of other martial arts styles. When I came to Wing Chun, I also feel that that was my advantage. Even though Wing Chun was very different from Taekwondo and what I had done before, my last Taekwondo instructor was a fresh off the boat Korean who barely spoke any English. And he used to teach us Alex, okay, now you do this. And then he would show me a 15 kick combo. Pop, 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 pop. Okay, you do it like that. You got it? Okay, go. And there wasn't my students. But Sifu, so on the first kick, so where do I put my foot? And then how do I move? Do it. And then so you learn very quickly, if you were going to thrive in that environment, you had to be a visual learner and you had to pick it up very quickly. So then later when I started learning Wing Chun, I would listen obviously to what my Wing Chun instructor said, but I would just watch how they did it and I would just copy how they did it, even if I didn't understand what they were doing. Because I'm like, hey, this person's been doing this for 20 years. When they, do this punch, they move their shoulder a little bit this way. I don't know why. Most people, they always want to ask, why do you move your shoulder that way? They get an answer and they still don't do it. I was always like, the Sifu is moving their shoulder when they punch. I'm going to move my shoulder when I punch. And later I'll find out why, but I'll already be able to do it. So I actually find that sometimes mimicking things, even if you're not 100% sure why, is the first step to then later really figuring out how to do it. And whether people are wired that way it's regardless of their previous background. You either are wired that way or you're not.
Yeah. I guess that would explain why some of the great martial arts actors and actresses in, those old Shaw Brothers movies, you found that they were actually like Chinese opera.
Yes.
As opposed to they found out, oh yeah, well, like you said on the previous podcast, they didn't actually have formal training.
Right.
But you wouldn't know that watching them on the movie.
Right. They didn't have formal, specific martial arts training. Yeah. They had general martial arts training. I remember a couple of years ago, I was in Hong Kong and I was having dim sum. I'm going to sound like David Carradine now. I'm going to name drop. Listen to me. What a hypocrite, right? Talking shit about David Carradine. Here I am. But of course, because that was me 20 years ago. This is me 20 years later now. Okay. Now I'm the accomplished Kung Fu genius. Let me tell you the people I've had dim sum with, all right?
is this when you start telling people how much the podcast is going to start being charged for? Because everything costs money.
Yeah, everything costs money, son. You want to hear those stories? Everything costs money. I had dim sum in Hong Kong with Siu Hao. Siu Hao is a Shaw Brothers legend. He was the star of Mad Monkey Kung Fu. Mm-hmm. But he also was in a lot of, he was in the Lao Ka Leung team. So he was in 36 Chambers. He had in some movies, he had more bit roles. In other movies, he was a little bit more prominent. He was an eight diagram pole fighter.
Oh, yes, love that movie.
But he was the star of Mad Monkey Kung Fu, and he's amazing. His name is literally Little Monkey. And we were sitting there, and it was just weird sitting across from him, having watched him so much as a kid. And I'm pouring tea for him, and it's just super weird. I was so nervous, right? And it was funny because when we met him, he was the first thing he said was, oh, My friend is coming today too. I hope you don't mind that he joins us for dim sum. He used to be a stuntman. He was in Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee. Do you mind if he comes? I was like, what? What? Yeah. He was amazing, right? I was like, yeah, of course, right? And his surname was Chang. And he gave this. So there I am, like, talking to both of these guys. It was amazing. And Siu Hao was asked, like, when you did, because he was also in Legendary Weapons of China.
Oh, another great film.
And he said, when you guys did those fight scenes, how long did it take to choreograph those things? Because they're very intricate. I mean, when you look at Lau Kar Leung's choreography, it's really high level. And you, in one shot, you have so many beats that change. And really, you got to be able to do it. And he said, Lau Sifu, which is what they call Lau Kar Leung, he said, he would run through it once with us to figure it out, one time to kind of rough out the edges, and the third time we shot it. And it was like, so the only people that he would pick to be on his team were people who could mimic that stuff right away. There was no like, no, I need you to put your right foot here, then turn your head, and then do it. Like, they didn't have time for that. They go, look, we're going to go bump, 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 bump. Okay, let's do that again. I want you to do this. Okay, go this way. All right, one more run through. Okay, all right, let's go in and film. And they were shooting on film. They didn't want to waste film. So if you messed up and got an NG, which meant no good. If you got an NG, that was like a huge shame because you wasted actual film.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And so, again, mimics. If you're able to mimic stuff, I think that that's a huge asset in learning martial arts.
Okay, next question. Foo for thought.
Mm.
Quick question. I know it's impossible to actually know, but do you think the landscape of action cinema would be different had Bruce Lee lived? For example, would Jackie Chan be the star he is today? Love the podcast. Keep up the good work.
That's an amazing question. I love these kind of thought experiments because they can really go anywhere, right? Had Bruce Lee not died? Well, it's interesting because Bruce, at the time of his death, he told Sek Yin, Han from Enter the Dragon, that he really wanted to become a producer or a director. So I think that he saw that, you know, that's where the real money was made. And so it's difficult to tell because I also think he liked to a certain degree being a movie star. I think he liked being like the guy, but he was also very forward thinking and he knew that he probably wouldn't be at that level forever, at least physically. So he was looking forward to the future. So he knew Jackie Chan and he knew Sammo Hung. I mean, these were guys who had done stunts on his team. It's possible that if he got into producing or more writing or directing, he would have used them more. So I think they still would have had careers, but whether they would have become the big stars that they later became, if they were still under his shadow, if he was still around, it's difficult to tell. I think Bruce kind of wanted to do some more comedy stuff because he did like Way of the Dragon, which was a kung fu comedy. Mm-hmm. He may have been able to recognize that in Jackie Chan earlier because Jackie Chan's career kind of had all these stalls before he really became Jackie Chan as we know it. Because right after Bruce Lee's death, they were trying to find the next Bruce Lee. So they even put Jackie Chan in movies that were directed by Lo Wei, who directed Bruce's first two films. And they were trying to make Jackie like a second coming of Bruce Lee. New Fists of Fury and stuff like that, right? But the problem is Jackie Chan is not a tough guy. And these movies bombed. Most of Jackie Chan's movies and these cheap movies he made in Taiwan in the mid-70s, they're horrible. I know there are people like they like Fearless Hyena, a couple other ones, like, but it's not quite the Jackie Chan you know now.
Yeah, I actually found on Netflix, and it was billed as Jackie Chan's like first, like, not starring role, but like main role. He was in a supporting role. I can't even remember the name of the film, but I turned it off after about 20 minutes, half an hour, because it just wasn't very good.
No, it was unwatchable.
Yeah, he was like, even the press photo they had on the Netflix thing was just him, like, in the back of this car trying to look mean, and I'm like... Yeah,
and it didn't work, right?
No, absolutely not. So you're not, like, that's not who he is, right?
Yeah, and it took them a while to figure that out. So Jackie, they knew he was talented, but they just kept trying to make him a tough guy, and it wasn't working. It wasn't until Si Yun, the producer... who had his own company called Seasonal, had this idea to put Jackie in a comedy and then made Snake and Eagle Shadow. And he basically had him on loan for those two films. And Snake in the Eagle's Shadow was such a huge success. And then they basically remade the film as Drunken Master. It's basically the same movie, same cast. And it was a huge success. And then they're like, oh, kung fu comedies. And then that started to become the rage. And Jackie was like on top of it. And then a few short years later, Jackie decides to move away from the kung fu genre and start to do modern action movies, but with comedy and stunts. And that really became his thing. You know, Project A is like that, well, the first kind of modern action movie, I think, that he made. And it's just, even to this day, it's so good. The stunts are so good. The fighting is so good. And it's just so ahead of everything. Mm-hmm. U.S. market also wanted a second coming of Bruce Lee. And so they went back there. They went to Raymond Chow. Hey, I got this guy, Jackie Chan. The first attempt to make an American film with Jackie Chan was a film called The Big Brawl. And again, they tried to make him kind of a tough guy. So, the American, they didn't know what to do with Jackie Chan. So they made him kind of a tough guy, and they did a Big Brawl, and it was a flop. And it was, I think, with Warner Brothers, and they even got Robert Klaus, the same guy who directed Enter the Dragon. I think it was Robert Klaus. And it was a flop. It was like, you know, Hollywood producers, we'll get some Chinese guy and we'll get the same guy who directed this movie and it'll be great and the kids will love it. Yeah. Right? And they did it, and it was a pile of dog. And Jackie went back to Hong Kong feeling kind of dejected, having had this failure. But Battle Creek Brawl gave him the idea to make Project A. And Project A becomes this like crowning achievement of modern stunt action and comedy. And it's amazing because it was set in the same time period. That's where he got the idea to do something in that time period. So his first big failure in the US gave him a huge hit in Hong Kong. Then he got a second lease on life to make a film in America. And that film was called The Protector.
Oh, yes.
And that was kind of a modern cop movie. And again, they tried to make him a tough guy. And his English, I mean, his English is not great now, but it was way worse in the early 80s. And they tried to give him like Clint Eastwood type lines, like, yeah, you got the guts, pull your gun. You know what I mean? And like, just like the same thing when Jet Li made movies. I mean, Jet Li doesn't really speak English, so they fed him his lines in English.
Yeah.
But I think what American producers don't realize is when you have someone with such a thick accent who's saying it awkwardly because the lines are read, they don't say things like, hey, man, you got the guts? Go ahead and draw the gun. Because there's a chart between, like, how good your English is and your word choice, right? And yeah. No one with, like, that thick of an accent speaks this way. So that's why they always come off unnatural, right?
Yeah.
So Jackie makes this movie where he's, like, a tough guy cop, and it flops. And he's so disappointed in it. He actually reshoots the ending in Hong Kong with Hong Kong stuntmen because he's so embarrassed and doesn't want that American film shown in Hong Kong because people know what he's capable of doing. So he reshot the ending to The Protector with a Hong Kong stunt crew, and that was the version that was released in Hong Kong because he didn't even want them to see the crappy American version. In fact, Bill Wallace, who was the villain in that movie, when Jackie started to become big after Rumble in the Bronx, he's like, it's not true that Jackie Chan does all of his stunts, because when I was on The Protector, he wasn't doing all of his stunts and blah, blah, blah. Well, it is true. Jackie has used stuntmen even in his Hong Kong films.
Yeah.
But in his American films, he has to use stuntmen because of American insurance laws.
Yeah.
Right? So I remember reading that article by Bill Wallace in Inside Kung Fu and just going, what a sour grapes.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. And that's also part of the reason why his American films were not as good, because the American stunt crews were slow and he had to be doubled. But he makes this flop police movie in America, goes back to Hong Kong and gets the idea to make Police Story. His two kind of biggest flops in the US at that time gave him like two of his most iconic films in Hong Kong. So Jackie was really someone who took lemons and made lemonade. Mm-hmm. And then he decided not to try to recrack the American market until Rumble in the Bronx.
Yeah.
But Rumble in the Bronx, despite the fact that it's got Bronx in the title, it's actually shot in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. If you ever watch it, you go, there are no snow-capped mountains in Bronx. Yeah. I'll take you to the Bronx. The Bronx right here. There are no mountains in the Bronx.
And then there's that whole scene right at the end on the boat. And that's like it's not, you couldn't even say that that's anything close to the East River or the Hudson or anything.
Not at all. It's way too clean.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. I love that movie, though. But the reason why Rumble the Bronx was a success is because it was the first time he tried to break the American market but not by making a film in America.
Yeah.
It was one that was shot in Canada, but it was a Hong Kong film. It was shot with a Hong Kong stunt crew. He did things his own way. So basically he decided, for my third attempt, I'm going to make a Hong Kong movie and release that in the US so people can see what I can actually do.
Yeah.
And that's how Rumble in the Bronx became like this big thing. Obviously, had Bruce Lee still stayed alive, those events would have been very different, right? He wouldn't have maybe had the chance to make those films in the States. Maybe it would have happened sooner. Maybe it would have happened later. Maybe it would have never happened. But super difficult. I mean, you know, it's a very interesting thought experiment. Like, what would have... I mean, also now, given all the new Bruce Lee drug letters, I mean, had Bruce Lee not died then, would he have died 2 years later?
Or alternatively, maybe he wouldn't have died and just become a Hollywood prick.
Yeah, or a burnout.
Yeah, or a burnout. Because the thing about it is these thought experiments about people are fascinating, but you can never tell, because it's always about people whose potential was
robbed.
It's like, oh, it's amazing, right? Enter the Dragon was fabulous. All of that kind of very brief period, you know. And you say, like, see that in all the musicians as well. What would have happened if Jimi Hendrix had lived, right?
Right.
How different would it be? Well, he could have gone on and continued to have been awesome. But it's like when Prince died, and he died, what, 57 years old?
Right.
He was amazing, but everyone has seemingly forgotten that a lot of his last 10, 15 years of output kind of sucked.
Right.
Compared to his 70s and 80s heyday.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Right?
So, you know, it's like, yeah, we like to think it. I mean, there's no doubt that it probably would have been radically different if he had lived.
Yeah, of course.
But, like, how?
It's not linear the way people... It's not like Bruce Lee was going this way and got cut off here and would have kept going that way.
Yeah.
I'm of the impression that whatever Bruce Lee lived, whatever he did after Enter the Dragon would have flopped.
Right.
Because Enter the Dragon was so baller. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like Game of Death, he didn't even really have a script for. I think like his next movie would have been a big turkey. That doesn't mean his career would have been over, but I'm of the opinion whatever he would have done immediately after the Enter the Dragon would have sucked. Because either it would have been him finishing Game of Death, which I don't think was going to be great, or it would have been... Like, because now Hollywood sees, oh, this Bruce Lee guy, he's the new hot ticket. So let's put him in a movie with Jack Nicholson and Sophia Loren and blah, 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 you know, and then it's going to be just some box, you know, boilerplate movie that no one gives a crap about. Right.
But he gets paid as well.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. So all of a sudden, hey, look at this Asian guy. He can really kick ass. And then you get this like kind of law of diminishing returns, whether it's like Enter the Dragon 2 and then 3.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
You like to think he would
enter harder.
No, that's Kung Fu Genius After Dark.
Yeah, I think that is also an issue. Like you said about Prince's last few years, look at Elvis. Elvis, obviously one of the biggest icons, king of rock and roll. I'm of the opinion Elvis died 5 years too late.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, not to say he should have died at any, but like think about it. Had Elvis died before he became fat, bloated, drug-addled Elvis, he would even be bigger.
Yeah.
Because you never would have seen him kind of go into that weird decline in the end of his, like that YouTube video where he's on stage and he's high as hell and he doesn't even remember the words of the song. Elvis was still such a big star. You know, there's that video on YouTube where he's singing Are You Lonesome Tonight?
Yeah.
And you know in that song, there's like a part, it's not a rap, but it's like this spoken word part. He's like, well, baby, I just want you to... I don't remember the words, but like, it's, are you lonesome tonight? And it's like, baby, I just want to tell you... Like, there's this weird spoken word part, right? And there's this live performance you can see on YouTube of Elvis doing that, I think, very shortly before he passed.
Yeah, I've seen it.
And it's forgets amazing. The words.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going like, brother, plus tax. Well, you damn fool, forgot the words, right? And Elvis was such a big star. He's literally forgetting the words on stage and everyone just claps.
Yeah.
I'm like, at that point, he could have taken a dump on the stage. The audience would have just clapped for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we still saw that.
Yes.
Had Elvis died 5 years earlier, it would have been like, what would Elvis have done had he lived? Well, he'd become a fat, bloated, drug crazy dude on stage. So given what we do know about Bruce now, you know, because of the Bob Baker letters, I don't know that the next few years would have been all sunshines and rainbows. I mean, there were rumors about the state of Bruce Lee's marriage with Linda at the time of his death. Obviously, his drug habit wasn't getting lighter as he went on. And his struggles with people within Hong Kong were getting kind of bigger. So maybe Bruce passed away at the right time, unlike mm-hmm. Elvis,
yeah,
for his legacy.
Absolutely. All which right? is a sad, because you don't want to ever, you don't want anyone to pass
no,
away.
Of course not. Like, but this is all hindsight thought experiment anyway.
Yes.
That's why it's very difficult to see it any other way. I don't mm-hmm. know. All right, what do we got?
Okay, cool. All right, then. So, Paradise Lost.
Why you look so apprehensive? This isn't another Dreyson time machine question, is
no,
it?
No, it's not.
By the way, I'm so happy we don't have a Dreyson question this week.
Hey, there's still time. There is still time. All right, but, you know, fingers crossed. No, I just think you might eye roll, you know, with apologies to our questioner. Paradise Lost. Do you ever apply footwork or hip rotation outside of your martial arts into your martial arts?
That's not a controversial question at all. I thought you were going to hit me with some kind of bomb right there.
You know, as I reread it, maybe it's not quite as controversial. Maybe I'm just trying to manufacture some controversy.
Oh, I see. Controversy. I think you put the emphasis on the wrong syllable right there.
I'm sorry. It's just that whole English accent thing. I'm finding it hard to, you know, when you start speaking English properly, it's a bit.
Does your mouth get tired speaking that way?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I get a little bit kind of dizzy on my pet, like, you know, high horse.
Right. Yes, I can imagine. You have all that extra enunciation on those syllables, but you do save effort on the T's.
I have no idea what you are talking about.
I'm thoroughly of the opinion that whatever martial art you do, you should be more mobile than what your specific martial art requires you to do. Some of my friends who come from the different kung fu backgrounds, whether it's Choi Lei Fut or whatever, they have such a broad base of movements in their forms. They, in my opinion, tend to be much more well-rounded athletes than a lot of Wing Chun practitioners. That's not to say whether one style is better for fighting or the other, but truthfully, when I look at a lot of Wing Chun instructors out there, they don't really move like athletes. They might be very good at using Wing Chun and stepping in and hitting and chain punching the shit out of the other guy, and launching the other guy with the palm strike or whatever. But like when you just look at the way they move, they don't generally move in a very athletic way. And I found that the Wing Chun sifus who do focus on athletic movement beyond, because in Wing Chun you could say, look, we only need to punch straight, we only need to step this way, we only need to kick this way, because that's all we need to be effective in fighting. Okay, that's another argument altogether. But what ends up happening is Wing Chun people are really good at moving in those planes of movement at the expense of being able to move in any other plane of movement. And I find that if you can only move in one specific plane of movement, you will never move as good in your plane of movement of choice as if you can also move in other planes of movement. You will move much better in your plane of movement of choice. So I just find that you can kind of tell there's some Wing Chun people out there who are really phenomenal in terms of movement. And I think their Wing Chun looks much better, even when they're just doing the straight Wing Chun,
right.
Looks better because they have a better movement vocabulary. Obviously, people like Sifu Heinrich Pfaff, and you know, there are other people out there, I think Mark Stas. You know, he moves, I think he has a Taekwondo background and he moves really well. And as a result, his Wing Chun or whatever he calls it in general looks better than a lot of the other people out there. And then, so you find that doesn't matter the lineage within the different lineages, whether it's Wong Chun Leung or Leung Ting or whatever, you see some people who move a little bit more athletic and have additional hip rotation and movements and stuff that are not necessary for Wing Chun. And I think their Wing Chun just looks better and they move better as a result.
Right. Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. All right, actually, you know what? I was warming you up for this, which is definitely a controversial question.
Oh, crap.
Okay. Rick does Paranormal.
That does sound controversial.
Also, KFG After Dark. What are your thoughts on William Chang and his style of Wing Chun?
Ooh, wow, this is really crazy. You know, in the old days, people don't realize in the old days of the AMA, the Ask Me Anything episodes, basically we got all these questions on the YouTube comments. And you, Dre.
Absolutely, me.
I was going to say Dre and I, but I'm like, but you're right here. Why would I speak to you in third person? That's kind of weird.
Absolutely.
We would just kind of go through the questions and I go, okay, this is good, this is good, this is good, right? But in the last four episodes, I go, all right, I don't want to know the questions in advance. I mean, I didn't plan what I was going to say, but I knew before the episode what questions were coming up.
Right.
I've since said, you know what? Now we just throw the questions on there And what, like, I'd rather be surprised. I think the answer comes off a little bit more organic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was partially to avoid questions like these.
Well, you know, I'd like to keep you on your toes, Seifert.
Yes, yes. And the reason why I don't like answering these kind of questions is because these are old wounds from the 80s, all right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, I come originally from the Leung Ting lineage and the William Cheung lineage, both from the Yip Man style of Wing Chun, traditionally not very friendly with each other and have, let's say, they have a past, all right? So I also feel that anything I would say about Sifu William Cheung might get colored in the idea, oh, well, this is a Leung Ting guy's opinion about William Cheung.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel if I came from any other lineage, I would be maybe more open to answering this question, because anything I say is going to sound like, well, obviously those Leung Ting guys don't like the William Cheung guys. All I'm going to say is this: I don't actually care. All right, like, and I'm not being dismissive of William Cheung. When I was a teenager, I did all my research in the different lineages, right? And I think sometimes people have this opinion, well, if you did this lineage, it's because you haven't seen this one yet, or you haven't experienced this one yet. When I was a teenager, I really did actually experience most of the mainstream Wing Chun lineages that are out there before I came to WT. I had tried guys who were in the Leung Seung lineage. I had tried guys who were in the William Cheung lineage. Mostly Leung Seung, some William Cheung guys, and also some Wong Sun Leung guys as well. So I tried these different lineages, and WT, the Leung Ting lineage, was the one that I kind of fell in love with. So it's not like there was a WT school around the corner, and I did that, and I did it at the expense of ever seeing all the other Wing Chun lineages out there. When I was a teenager, I had William Cheung's poster on my wall. Okay, mm-hmm. Just to give you an idea.
Yeah.
Before I really got invested in, like, so I had all of his books and I, you know, read about his style. So later, of course, I started doing WD. And then, of course, one of my Sihing, Sifu Yimin, had a famous altercation with William Cheung in 1986. And so ever since then, it's like, well, if you're a WT guy, obviously you must not like the William Cheung guys or whatever. There are two William Cheung groups who teach here in New York City. And pre-pandemic, both of them were renting my space on the weekends to teach their classes, right? Which I famously like to say, I'm the only WT guy who ever made money off of William Cheung. Right? and the reason is because, you know, on Sunday or whatever, I don't teach on Sundays. I know these guys from the William Cheung line. They have they don't really have a lot of students. They just need a place to teach. And what better than a place that already has wooden dummies and stuff like that? So they rent the space from me on the weekends and I let them teach. And they're two separate William Cheung groups and two different Sifus. And from what I understand, like, you know, obviously everyone is friendly with each other, but maybe they're both from the William Cheung line, but they like to keep their things separate. That maybe they don't commingle too much or whatever, right?
Uh-huh.
And both of them teach at my place separately, of course, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I personally have absolutely no problem with the William Cheung guys, and I know many of them and consider many of them good friends, and consider a lot of those guys, you know, who are higher up on the food chain, they're very skillful, they're knowledgeable, they teach their art, they respect their sifu or sigong. So for me, I don't have a problem with that. The reason why people ask this all the time, one is because of the history between WT and the William Cheung line. And two, William Cheung in particular has made pretty large claims about where his style comes from. Because he doesn't teach, let's say, what one would call orthodox Wing Chun of the Yip Man line. William Cheung claims that during the time he was learning from Grandmaster Yip Man, Grandmaster Yip Man taught him privately, separate from the other students, and taught him a style of Wing Chun that was quite different from what Yip Man was teaching everyone else. So in other words, that the traditional Wing Chun style that William Cheung does is, to a certain degree, a secret lineage within Wing Chun that was passed down only to him from Yip Man and not to any of the other students of Grandmaster Yip Man. So Grandmaster Yip Man in the late 50s saw this teenager, William Cheung, and decided that not to teach this super secret special style to everyone else or all of his other students or private students, but he was just going to teach it to this one teenager and make him essentially swear an oath not to divulge this secret style of traditional Wing Chun. And then at the time when Yip Man died, William Cheung felt, well, now he should be free to teach the style, right?
Seems legit.
My main thing with that story is that people ask me to debunk it. And first of all, I'm too busy teaching. I'm too busy doing my own thing. I don't have any skin in the game, and I don't like to relitigate. These are wounds from the 80s, and these are wounds from the early days of the internet before social media and everything was on those forum message boards, mm-hmm. and all the William Cheung guys are going at it with the, and like, so I mean, for me, it's relitigating old stuff, and it doesn't bring the argument any further. And people who like William Cheung's Wing Chun are going to continue to do so no matter what I say about it. And people who like WT or other styles of Wing Chun are going to continue to do that no matter what I say about it. So no one is going to listen to a well-reasoned argument as to why the claims may or may not be true and go, well, I guess I will leave the style, or I guess I will join that style. And I don't think me talking about it and what I feel about the veracity of his claims is going to make anyone feel better, yeah. All right? I think that if you learn William Cheung's style of Wing Chun, and you like it, then do it, right? And if you don't like it, or you don't believe his claims, or whatever, then don't do it, right? but I'm not trying to take people away from them or tell people to go to them or whatever. I just feel that it's not my job to debunk it because I'm not the one making a claim about it.
Yeah.
What people sometimes forget is, the burden of proof is on the claim maker,
yes.
not the other way around.
Yeah.
So if someone wants to claim that they learned a style of Wing Chun secretly when they were a teenager and that the Yip Man did not teach this style to anyone else, then all your work is ahead of you because you now have to prove that claim. And you have to prove that claim against the evidence that's out there about what Grandmaster Yip Man learned in Fa Can and what other lines that have nothing to do with Yip Man, teach. And you have to now find this style somehow in China if it exists. And they have all their work ahead of them if that's what they're going to do. If you think that it's a better style of Wing Chun functionally, then that's fine. That's another story. But when you want to make a claim historically about where it comes from, the burden of proof is on you for that. It's not me to debunk it. It's for someone to actually prove that that's true. And I'm willing to hear those arguments if someone's got them. And that's all I'm going to say about that topic. I think we got time for one more.
C.T. Leffler, you hop in the patented KFG time machine.
Patented? I think it's patented.
Well, you would think that, wouldn't you?
You're very snarky this week, Dre.
I can't help it. It's just... Anyway, stick with me, in brackets, and go to the year 2061. In that 40-year time span, how has WT changed and what has influenced those changes?
Ooh, time machine forward to the future. Yeah. WT, what is it going to be? You want my true unvarnished answer? I think WT, Wing Chun, the specific lineage of Leung Ting Wing Chun, is not going to be much in 40 years of the future. I don't think any specific lineage of Wing Chun is going to be much in 40 years. I think everything evolves and you have offshoots of offshoots of offshoots. So I think, will there be someone in 40 years who claims to teach pure Leung Ting WT as Leung Ting taught it? I doubt that very highly. There are very few people, even those in Sifu Leung Ting's organization, who teach pure WT now, and he's still alive, okay? People who teach real orthodox Hong Kong-style WT, there are very few people who do that right now, the way Sifu Leung Ting does it, and he's still alive. Why in 40 years from now anyone would think that there's someone who does that, I don't believe that at all. I think that WT is going to continue to evolve. In the opinions of some people, they might think it's devolving because you're not teaching it in the traditional canonical way according to Leung Ting, but that's a separate argument. I think the European Wing Chun organization, they've already They've already developed it in a very different direction. Already what they do right now is quite different from Leung-Ting's WT. So 40 years from now, that's going to be even further out in a different direction. What we're doing here, you know, teaching classical Wing Chun, but with updated training methods, I hope that in 40 years, if there are people who are still carrying on the banner of what I do, that they continue to evolve it. And evolve doesn't just mean mix stuff willy-nilly, meaning really evolve the Wing Chun to adapt to the modern times. Whatever that means is up to people in the future. It's not up to me now to say what that evolution is, because I don't know where things are going to go. I would hope that it evolves. I would be very annoyed if people try to teach it as only as a museum piece of what I taught or what Leung-Ting taught. I think they would be missing the point. I think it would be good for people out to be out there who knew what Sifu Leung-Ting taught in this way, and this is how he taught it, and Sifu Kanchbek taught it like this, and Alex taught it this way, and Sifu Carson Lau taught it this way. There can be Kung Fu geniuses in the future who are total nerds who know that stuff. But that doesn't mean that they should be bound by teaching it exactly that way, because then at that point, they're propping up the museum piece of how one person did it over what's more important for the evolution of the style. If the founders of Wing Chun didn't feel that they needed to evolve and create something, Wing Chun itself would never have been created, because they would have stuck to whatever martial art they were doing before. They wouldn't have created something new. Our founders were by definition very progressive, because they broke away from whatever traditional styles they were doing to create Wing Chun in the first place. It's like the founders were very progressive. Everyone who comes after that, extremely traditional and orthodox and bound by orthodoxy. I would hope that people break that after a while. That doesn't mean do whatever you want and call it Wing Chun. That doesn't mean just mix stuff willy-nilly and call it Wing Chun. That really means stay to the original concepts of Wing, stay true to the original ideas of Wing Chun. The training methods and the techniques 100% can evolve, but stick to the principles and ideas, and it's still Wing Chun, in my opinion. I hope that's what happens. But I don't think that 40 years from now, there's going to be people teaching, oh, I teach traditional WT, or I teach traditional Wong Sun Lang Wing Chun. I don't think in 40 years, I think you're going to have new names. The next generation of names is going to be out there. Yip Man did not teach Chan Ma Shun Wing Chun. He didn't claim to say, I teach Leung Chan Wing Chun or Chan Ma Shun Wing Chun. He didn't even say he taught Yip Man Wing Chun. He just said he taught Wing Chun. And now 2-3 generations after that, people go, I teach Yip Man Wing Chun. No, you don't. You don't. Just at some point, you should be confident enough to just say, I just teach Wing Chun. Not Alex Richter Wing Chun, not City Wing Chun, not Wong Sun Leung Wing Chun, not David Peterson, just Wing Chun. If you trust in what you do, then just call it Wing Chun. Stop putting appendices to the name, you know? It's just Wing Chun, right? And I hope the future of Wing Chun can be just Wing Chun. And that's all I got to say about that. All right, guys, well, that was the episode. What did you think about today's episode? And what questions do you have for me to answer on a future episode of The Kung Fu Genius? Go ahead and write those in the comments below, and I'll see you guys next time. Word is I'm a Kung Fu genius. Technique speaks for me, not lineage. Forget Jet Li, cause I'm the one. Many call me Sifu, but to you I'm Seagung. And I produce masters. You surpass us, your Kung Fu stiffer than corpse and caskets. City Wing Chun is the house I built. Violate the gate and your blood gets spilt. Alex Richter, always the... All right, guys, so what did you think of today's episode? And what questions do you have for me in for a future episode? All right, let me do that again. I f***ed that up.
Appreciate the podcasts. It's fun and important. Excuse me. Wow. Accent getting me there. Appreciate the podcast.
Two takes. Both of them were fine. You're really on a roll. So sophisticated.
Just call me butter, baby.
Unbelievable.
Sophistication. Don't talk to me about sophistication, lad. I've been to Manchester. I'm out.